This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bahnsen Institute, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.
We decided we'd make a little bit of a change tonight. In the last couple Bible studies, we've been looking at interpersonal relations, and last time we talked about the modern view of sexuality and its effect on our society. But tonight we're going to change gears and talk a little more philosophically about the defense of the Christian faith. That's basically what the word apologetics means. Apologetics is the defense of the faith. That's a little misleading, I realize, because in terms of English usage, to apologize is not really to defend yourself, but to say, I'm sorry for being wrong. But in the Greek world, an apology was an answer given to an accusation made against you. Any of you who may have had a beginning class in philosophy will remember the apology. It's one of the dialogues written by Plato and describes the last days of Socrates and the defense that he offered in the court in Athens against the charge that he corrupted the youth of Athens and was propagating foreign gods or strange gods. So, from the Greek, apologetics is to give a defense, to give an answer to an accusation. In 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 15, we find what amounts to the Magna Carta of Christian apologetics. It's the biblical reason why we're so interested in apologetics. Here Peter says, "But sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is in you, yet with gentleness and reverence." It's interesting to me that this is not a suggestion. It's not even a description of what everybody's going to be interested in. It's a commandment. Peter says, you are to be ready to answer accusations made against the Christian faith. You should be prepared to give an account of the hope that is in you. When somebody hears that you're a Christian, you have this hope of eternal life, this hope that's based upon a transcendent, personal, eternal God. When people hear this testimony and they challenge it, you must be prepared to respond to that, to give a defense. And so, tonight, the question is, how do we do that? How do we fulfill this commandment? How do we give an answer to anybody who should ask us for a reason or an explanation or defense of the hope that is in us? Turns out that if I'm to be oversimple and generalize here, there's two basic approaches to the defense of the faith that are current in evangelical circles, that are conservative, Bible-believing Christian circles. Very broadly speaking, I would say you have what could be called the evidentialist approach to the defense of the Christian faith, evidential apologetics. On the other hand, you have what will be called presuppositional apologetics. Now, all of this means nothing to you, it's only labels, but I want to lay out a little groundwork so you see the categories in which we're going to be talking. Evidential apologetics is one method of defending the faith. Presuppositional apologetics is another method of defending the faith, and both have their adherents. And I want to make it very clear, both schools of thought can enlist in their support men who are very godly, men who are well-read, who have good minds, good hearts, and are really intending to serve the Lord. It's really a question of what is the best methodology, and the methodology that most comports with all the other teaching of Scripture as to how we should conduct our lives and how we should think as God's people and that sort of thing. So it's not a question of who really is a Christian and who's not. This is a discussion within Christian circles. Okay? And the reason I'm so sensitive about that and want to stress it is that often when Christians start debating what method they should use in defending the faith, we treat each other more like the enemy than those who are outside the faith. We end up trying to debate and win arguments with one another rather than dealing with those who, you know, need the gospel and who are outside the church altogether. While I have a definite opinion as to which of these two is the most biblical and most successful approach to defending the faith, nevertheless, I begin with healthy respect for both sides, both opinions. What do we mean by evidential apologetics? if I want to present Christian evidences as a way of defending the faith, first of all, I want to say to my opponent, to the unbeliever who is challenging the faith, well, let's both of us try to rid ourselves of all of our assumptions as much as we possibly can. Let's both be just as neutral and as open-minded as we possibly can. Let's not have any pre-commitments. Let's not be leaning this way or that. Let's just be totally indifferent, open-minded, or neutral. Now, if we both approach the subject with an open mind, and we're going to be neutral in our opening point, we have to agree also on certain standards of argumentation that will be used. What will it take to convince you to say that we have justification for this or that claim? What sort of warrant is going to be accepted when we debate matters of truth and religion? Okay, so I talked to the unbeliever, and it turns out that we can agree now, believer and unbeliever can agree, that our starting point and our standard will be, let's say, the laws of logic. You can't contradict yourself. You must be consistent in argumentation. We will accept that what we learn through our senses is basically reliable, that, you know, when we see things or touch things, smell things, that that's the kind of evidence we're looking for. Those sorts of matters. So we start by being neutral, and then we talk to each other and we come to a common starting point and use a common standard of evidence, and then we approach the facts as open-minded, agreed upon in our standards, open-minded explorers who are going to find out what the facts actually tell us. Now, one of the facts, in fact, the primary fact, for those who hold to evidential apologetics, that is significant in defending the faith, is that the Bible records miracles, that God demonstrates the truth of his messengers, the truth of what the apostles and the prophets said, by mighty works, mighty wonders that were done. Now, here's the classic Old Testament illustration. Elijah meets the priest of Baal on Mount Carmel. And Elijah invites them to have fire come down from heaven at the direction of their elect God and to consume the sacrifice that's been laid on the altar. Okay, and they go into all these shenanigans and they moan and they groan and they chant and they try to get their God to do this. And Elijah sitting over there engaged in what's called holy mockery, making fun of them. What's wrong with your God on vacation? Will be falling asleep? This sort of thing. And they finally are frustrated. You know, they cut themselves. They tried to, you know, pacify the gods. They can't get anything done. So then Elijah, recall, has buckets of water poured on. You know, he's going to make it just as difficult as he possibly can. And with one simple prayer, whack, fire from heaven. And that, you see, that miracle is a way of demonstrating that Elijah serves the living and true God, and the priests of Baal are false in their religion. Or if you want to take a New Testament account, you have miracles of the apostles, either killing the lame man to rise up and walk, or, and this brings us really to the primary illustration of the miracle that verifies allegedly the truth of the Christian message, we have the resurrection of Jesus Christ. God is given the resurrection as a sign, as a wonder that is meant to verify the message that was preached by Jesus and the apostles. Now, you and I, being objective about this, neutral, agreeing on the laws of evidence and logic, sensation, whatever it may be, let's go to the facts of history and see what we are to make of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And the argument, I'm not going to take a lot of time to get into, but the argument basically says, how did the Christian church arise? We hear these 12 men, actually 11 with the death of Judas, dejected men. Their master has been martyred by the Roman high command. How is it the Christian church comes into existence out of that situation? Someone says, well, if the master rose from the dead, then that would be a way of accounting for that Christian church, and it could have begun in that way. In fact, that is the claim that was made. Now, if we examine these documents that make up the New Testament, they're found to be basically reliable documents. They're old, they're well attested, and they're found to be good historical sources. The evidence here indicates that, for whatever else you want to say about the situation, 3 days after Jesus was killed, the tomb was empty in which he was laid. Now, how do we account for that empty tomb? Now, here are all the theories. One theory says the disciples stole the body, and the defender of the Christian faith says, now, is that really very credible with all these Roman soldiers? You have 11 disciples. We're really to believe they overcame the soldiers and that they could still preach credibly, let the resurrection be believed, and forget it. Or the theory that Jesus never really died. He just swooned upon the cross. It appeared to people that he died, and in the cool of the grave, he revived, and 3 days later, he pushed the stone away from the door in this injured state and all the rest, and then presented himself to the world as the Lord of glory. Well, the defenders of Israel, that just isn't very reasonable. No reasonable man, follow the common sense, can believe that. Okay, and then there's this theory and there's that theory. Well, we eliminate all the theories, and what do we have left? Well, the only thing we have left is we have to account for the empty tomb and the assumption that Jesus rose from the dead. All right. Now, if that's true, then there is a grand miracle that verifies everything that Jesus himself taught. That proves that he is the Son of God. And if he's the Son of God, and that means everything he said is true, and if what he said is that whatever his apostles should teach is true also, then we have verified the Christian message. Now, that is basically, you know, that's very condensed, thumbnail sketch of evidential apologetics. We want to be neutral. We want to agree on our standards and starting point with the unbeliever, when we want to go to the facts and try to show that very probably something like the resurrection took place, and that if that's the case, then we can move out from that miracle to the verification of the rest of the Bible. Okay? Now, the presuppositional approach to Christian apologetics is the second category that I laid out for you a moment or two ago. Presuppositional apologetics says, no, we do not attempt to be neutral. In fact, it is impossible to be. No man is neutral, and we're just playing at a game if we think that we are. We all have our pre-commitments. We all have our assumptions, and try as we will, we cannot strip away all of those inclinations and those commitments that we have, our assumptions. Presuppositions are something that are always going to be there, because the presuppositions that you have will determine what you think are the proper standards of evidence and logic anyway. Moreover, not only is it impossible as a matter of fact, it is wrong as a matter of principle to try to be neutral. For Jesus says you can't serve two masters. You either are going to be committed to him or not. You can't serve the master of my intellectual sufficiency, if you will, the standards of unbelieving philosophy and science and historiography or what have you, and the master Jesus Christ. You can't really be neutral. And so the Christian should try to defend the faith by holding on to his presuppositions. And instead of asking the unbeliever, well, what can we agree on as a starting point in our standards? The Christian wants to say, let's look at your presuppositions and my presuppositions and see which of these presuppositions is going to allow for any kind of thinking, any kind of historical investigation, any kind of ethics, whatever the subject may be. Which of these world views that we have is going to allow for any intelligibility in our lives at all. So, what I do is I talk to the unbeliever and I want to find out what his outlook on life is. What's his view of the world? What's his view of man? His view of logic? His view of evidence? His view of free will and history? And whatever the subject that seems relevant to our conversation might be, I want to get his background. How is it that man has this unique dignity, that we're supposed to have an ethic? How is it that we can use laws of logic or that we can understand the facts of history? Now, if he has a view of the world, for instance, let's say he doesn't think there's a creator, he doesn't think there's a God who controls every event of history according to his preordained plan, and that whatever happens just happens by chance. If we live in a random chance universe, how is it there could be any connection between the facts that's intelligible to us? How is it that this chance soup in my head called a brain can look through the chance eyeballs that I have at this chance world around me and find any intelligible laws and connections that make sense? Why think that my memory is reliable? Why think that we have to use ethical standards of honesty and consistency when we argue? And on and on and on. And it turns out that the presuppositional says your presuppositions actually wipe out rationality. Make the knowledge of any fact unknowable, not just the knowledge of the resurrection. But you can't know anything. You can't know the nose, you know, on your face. You can't even know the most basic standards of life, living, thought, what have you. And on the other hand, the Christian then lays out his world. We believe that God has made the world, that he's such and such a God, that he made man in the following way, that history proceeds in this fashion. But there are miracles, of course, in the Bible that verify the message of God, on and on and on. And in terms of that world, in terms of that outlook on life, in terms of that philosophy, we can make sense of logic and history and ethics and all the rest. And so what we want to do is to present the intellectual challenge of the gospel in the following form, that it's either Christianity or nothing. That the world is sounding fury, signifying nothing if you're not a Christian, or everything can make sense and have its place and be interpreted and have intelligibility about it. And so let's examine the goals of the two systems of apologetics. The one system says, we're going to begin as open-minded, neutral people and come to the facts together and conclude that very probably, you know, this miracle took place, very probably that means that the rest of the Bible is true. Whereas the presuppositional approach doesn't want to end up by saying, well, very probably there's a God, and very probably Jesus was his son, and very probably he rose from the dead, and therefore very probably the Bible is the word of God and can be trusted. The presuppositionalist wants to say there's no doubt whatsoever but that the Bible is the word of God, and anybody who says otherwise doesn't have a foundation on which to stand, even to make his criticism stick. Okay, so we're trying to pull the rug out from under the unbeliever altogether. Now, these then are the two basic approaches to apologetics that are found today. And unless I miss my mark, I think probably the easiest one to follow is the evidential approach. That kind of catches people's fancy. It seems like it's intellectually respectable. We're going to be open-minded, that sort of thing. And it's very popular in evangelical circles. You walk into any Christian bookstore in Southern California, and you go to the section dealing with the defense of the Christian faith, apologetics, you're going to find what I've just said is the evidential approach. Is most of the books there are going to promote that sort of thing. Because we can all argue about the resurrection and try to give evidence for our faith in. It sounds real good, and it's something that everybody's supposed to be able to do. There's this other approach, you know, says, no, we're supposed to stick to our assumptions and our presuppositions. We're not settled for just probability, and let's go all the way and say it's Christianity or nothing. And it seems like a tougher system. We're asking for more. We're pushing harder. It doesn't seem to be as fair-minded or whatever our preconception or intellectual honesty is. Go ahead.
We have other groups in some of the interesting ways. Does that mean that we are all to be able to do what you're talking about, or some of us just called who are witnesses of course of the day, more like the group like we do? Would it be curious what happens to me, or give you a reflection of what it does to your life and what it is to you?
Yeah.
And, you know, and other people are getting
to I'm really glad that you asked that question because it's crucial that we catch this. Peter does not say, and some of you are going to be equipped to defend the faith. He doesn't say, Christ has distributed various gifts in the church, which of course is true, I'm not denying that. But Peter's not saying, there are some people called to be people who will drive to the daily vacation Bible school, bring little children with them. And other people will be given the gift of saying, Jesus changed my heart, it means a lot to me, and give this warm, personal testimony. And that other people are going to be able to do something like defend this intellectually, too. No, he says that we are all to be ready to present a defense for the hope that is in us. There's no qualification at all. Even if you should suffer for the sake of righteousness, you are blessed. And do not fear their intimidation. Do not be troubled. But sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is in you. So if you have the hope in you, you have to be willing to defend that hope. Anybody who can suffer...
Okay with that, because I'm not the type that I could just get up and intellectually talk to somebody as well, talk like how you're saying, because...
Well, I got a surprise. I think you can.
Well, I don't think maybe I can, but I mean, I don't think that you necessarily have to do that with everybody, but I mean, I know, I feel the same way. I tend to be more put back and... Well, we're more emotional, and I share what, you know, Christ has done for me, what he is in my life, and... And I don't know if I can sit there and talk to
somebody. Let's have a dialogue, okay? I'm going to do the devil's advocate. Let's go through this. You tell me now, what does it mean to be a Christian? Breather. No, you're I want everybody to open their mouth. We're not going to have a good discussion if we all say that.
So what do you want me to tell you?
Just briefly, pretend I'm an unbelieving friend, and we've met in a college classroom.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily start sharing crime with you unless the opportunity arose.
The opportunity just arose, okay?
Well, I think depending on what we're talking about, if I could bring in crime in conversation, because the time maybe she was going through something in her life that she was going to have a problem. You know, and then I could relate to him in a way that, well, this is what happened in my life, the after you were still in a fishing, but this is how I got through it, and this is what's in my life.
Patty, I'd love to believe that myself. It'd be a great emotional crutch if I could just believe Jesus lived and died and rose again and cared for me in the way that you say. And I'm glad that it makes you feel better, but after all, whistling in the dark is a nice approach psychologically, but I'm interested in the truth. The fact that it makes you feel good doesn't mean it's going to work for you. Now what do you say?
See, that, I probably was just saying, I'd be upset. I mean, that's my problem. I can't do that. I mean, I have never
done that. I won't do that. We won't listen until I can't do that. Because we're going to show you tonight you can't. Okay. That's fair.
You guys are stuck now, you know?
Okay. In a sense, that's what we're going to try to answer tonight. I'm going to show you. I'm obviously not going to lay out a whole seminary course in apologetics in 1 hour discussion. But I'm going to show you tonight that each and every one of us can fulfill this commandment. And I think, if I can go back to your original question, what you're struggling with is, well, I can't do it the way Dr. Bonson does it. I mean, I can't bring this philosophical stuff in and, you know, all this logic and, you know, whatever terms may be used. That's true. You can. But nobody expects you to either. The way you defend the faith is going to be in terms of your own vocabulary, your own way of thinking, and the way you talk to people has got to be natural. You can't try to imitate somebody else's third. But I think everybody has to do it.
And it has to be more than feeling and emotional type. I mean, right. You know the verse, you don't like faith, you don't show. A lot of times I tell people, well, you just have to have faith and just have to believe, you know, and a lot of things.
But if somebody says, what do you mean by faith? Just a kind of a leap in the dark, just a whistling? Don't back down from this.
I just feel like I'm not even scared.
Well, then you came to the right place. Right. That's what we're going to do. We're going to prepare you all for the study of faith tonight. Let's take a look at these two approaches and ask ourselves a few questions. Which of them works? Which of them is pleasing to the Lord? Which of them is biblical? I'm going to give you a problem. I'm going to play the devil's advocate here again for all of you. I'm going to throw out what I consider to be the thorniest problem in Christian apologetics, the most difficult thing that's brought up in the classroom, when I was studying for my PhD in philosophy. If I were to poll the unbelieving philosophical candidates studied with me and ask them, what is the number one problem in believing the theology set forth in the Bible, what would it be? I am sure that high on the list, the number one issue would be what is called the problem of evil. Problem of evil. What I want to do is I'm going to lay out the problem of evil. I'm going to play the part of an unbeliever. And I want you to consider how you would answer the problem of evil. And I'm going to take a look at the two different philosophical schools of apologetic, evidentialism and presuppositionalism, and show you how they would handle it. And then I'm going to try to resolve the difficulty for you, and in the process, tell you which one is most biblical, or at least as I perceive it. Okay? So here's the problem. Let me play the devil's advocate. If I understand that you Christians would tell me, I'm happy telling you tonight, the God that you worship and whom you say you love with all your hearts is a God who is all-powerful, and he's a God who plans the end from the beginning, that everything that happens in history doesn't happen by chance, but happens by the will of God, that God is the one who has made history proceed the way that it does, that he is all-powerful and that he is sovereign, that he has a plan that he's pursuing it for history. On the other hand, you tell me that this God is all-loving, that he's a benevolent God, that as benevolent he wishes good to take place, that he's not evil. He doesn't want tragedy and injustice and sin. In fact, it's contrary to his will. Therefore, if God is all-powerful, he can do whatever he wants to do. And if God is all-loving, what he wants to do is bring about maximum happiness for people and not tragedy and discomfort and pain. And so, if there is injustice, tragedy, or pain in this world at all, then either God doesn't want it, but isn't powerful enough to eliminate it, or God is powerful enough to eliminate it, but isn't loving enough to want to do so. How can you reconcile having an all-powerful God, an all-loving God, with the existence of evil round about us? You stop and think about the wars that have taken place throughout the history of man. You think about the homicides that have been committed. You think about the small children who have been molested and killed. You think about the gratuitous evil of mankind round about us. But I remember the story related by Dostoevsky and the brothers Karamazov, where one of the brothers, who is a priest, is being interrogated by another brother who finds it very difficult to hold to the Christian faith. And he wants to illustrate the exquisite evil that's possible in the hearts, in the activities of men. And he relates an incident having to do with people who had a child that wouldn't stop crying. And so what they did is they put the child out in the foyer, in the outhouse, and left the child there in the first rush of freezing winter weather. And the child, of course, this is terrible pain because of those exposed conditions. And the child, it turns out, messed her pants and was really screaming. This is a 2.5-year-old infant we're talking about now. And so the parents came and they actually spread the excrement in the child's mouth, punish her, and beat the child and left her out in the cold. And now the one brother come also says, if you were to construct a world in which your will would be done, could you have the will to ordain and allow that kind of evil treatment of even that one child once in history? Would you have the heart to do that, my lordship? Your brother has to stop and think and whispers. Now you all know stories that are equally as grotesque. The torture. You think of the way people are treated in prison in Iran. You think of the treatment that is given to prisoners of war anywhere in this world today. You think of the painful and mean things that we do, even in, quote, polite and civilized society, to one another. And one has to wonder whether God doesn't care enough to eliminate this, or whether God is not powerful enough to eliminate this. Is it really logically possible that you have an all-powerful God, an all-loving God, and the pain and the evil and the tragedy that you see around? Now that, you see, to me, is the most difficult problem that's Christian faith. So it just doesn't make sense. I wonder if any of you Christians can convince me that you can still believe in an all-powerful, all-loving God in the face of these situations.
Well,
a couple of things is, first, because a person has power like God, doesn't necessarily mean he's going to use it, or he may use it when he sees fit to use it. Secondly, I guess it depends on our concept of love. When God created Adam and Eve, he designed them to have a loving fellowship with him. In fact, the Bible, from Deuteronomy and in Matthew and the New Testament, the commandments are always the same, that thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and all thy mind and all thy soul. However, what happened was, and I can't explain this, but Lucifer, for one, decided to rebel against God, Lucifer being an angel of light.
Could God have prevented that? Was he powerful enough to prevent that?
Because he was using the example of the cards that evil will destroy itself eventually, and that's where we are with evil itself.
Okay.
And then God will vindicate it by not having anything to do with it, and then the right way will be set up in the second Earth wants made new.
Why would he have to teach that? The perfect people?
He's not teaching, huh? He's on trial, well, not on trial, but basically proving that evil destroys itself.
Well, why should he have to teach that?
But evil proof, God's not evil proving. Evil has its own way. Evil says we can do what we want, because that's what Satan says. And that's what's bringing about all the universal evil on the earth, is because each person says, I can do what I want. And how could each person know that if there wasn't like one figure behind all evil? All people couldn't know it, just like we couldn't know of God unless it was real. So evil has their leader, we have ours, and see the choices to be made. Well, the choice has already been told us that many will choose evil, and that's why the course of the earth is taking the direction it is.
Sounds very loud, but
because
if he doesn't allow it, he allows it in a certain way.
The wages of sin is death. All men die. So what is the penalty? All men pay the same.
Well, why did God allow men to sin?
He gave freedom of choice. To create anything without freedom of choice would be to create robots. In fact, does love us enough to give us that freedom.
Well, I'm not sure philosophically that you couldn't make men who are free that would do the right thing. In terms of what you Christians teach in your theology, supposedly after the new heavens and the new earth have been introduced in the eternal state, we're all going to have free will. We're not going to be robots. But nobody's going to sin in heaven and have to be cast into hell.
That's true, because we have had the example of what happens when we do sin.
So why didn't God start that way? Why do we have to end up that way? Why do we have to go through all the tragedy with the poor girl in the outhouse having her parents mistreat her? Why couldn't God just make a history and find out a history-wise, I mean, he has the power to do anything, remember? Why couldn't he just bring that situation that we're going to have at the end of history at the very beginning of history?
Because there would be someone that would say again that why do we have to follow that? We'll see how we
follow that. Wait. Wouldn't that be unrighteous for somebody to question the Lord like that?
Satan did it. Right. It happened the first time. So you see,
so where did that sin
if he was to like stop it at that point, there would be no proof that he was correct.
Why would he need proof if he made perfect people like they're going to be at the end of history?
He made people, part of what he says, he made people with free choice.
Yeah, but the people at the end of history are going to have free choice too.
Right.
You don't think that we'll go to heaven, that we're going to be robots, do you?
We get to heaven because of our choices.
That may be, but when we get to heaven, we're not going to lose our free will, are we? Are we ever going to use that free will in such a way as to sin and be cast out of heaven?
When we go to heaven, we don't have the humanly body that's plagued us now, we don't have Satan's temptation.
Well, aren't we all going to be resurrected someday and have a human body again that might then tempt us and we can cast out of God's
through presence? Christ. Through Christ, our heavenly form, yes.
Well, we're going to have...
However,
it is possible to have a physical body that isn't going to be tempted to sin. Why didn't God make us with those bodies to begin with? He could have. He had the power to do it. Why didn't he do it?
Because he doesn't know it. That's right. God did with Adam and Eve, okay?
Well, how did they sin then?
Well, there was only one commandment given us. That was that they were not to eat of the forbidden fruit.
Well, okay. They were also to be fruitful and multiply.
Yeah, well, God gave them sex organs and, you know,
yeah,
Adam was alone.
To use them.
And the ability to.
God said to create man for worship, for man to worship God. For
And so, and I know, it's your theology. You Christians tell me.
And so, since he created man for man to worship him, I guess I feel he needed to give man a free choice so that worship would be worship in the purest sense and not just a robot.
I agree. Free choice is essential. That makes sense to me, even as an unbeliever. But now, according to what you've been saying here,
why he gave the free choice.
But at the end of history, when we all go to be with Jesus Christ and live in his kingdom forever, we're still going to have free choice. And we're never going to use our free choice in an evil way.
Because we will have the knowledge then of what happens when we use it in an evil way. Because we will have seen what happened. Evil is him.
Why couldn't God have created me with that knowledge to begin with? He has the power to do it.
Because then they'd have the knowledge of evil. And that would have been... That was what happened after they ate the tree, not before, so they didn't have the knowledge.
In heaven, we're going to have that knowledge.
Right? Because we will see what happened over the course of history.
Well, how can God keep us if we have this knowledge of evil? That's a bad thing.
Well, it also says the thoughts of the old earth will not come to our minds.
So we won't have a knowledge of evil because we won't be able to remember.
Well, all we'll have is the knowledge of what God has thought, and man's job would be to think God's thoughts after
him. Well, why didn't he just think his thoughts after him at the beginning then?
We did.
Well, then from whence come the wars and tumults among us then? Satan. Well, where did Satan come from? Was he not only
Satan's rebellion, but also our own rebellion?
The unbeliever can't supply you with it.
I'll ask you a question. On what basis, sir, are you talking about good and evil? You're presupposing that there's a moral good and a moral evil. You're talking about evil, and I'd like to know where, from a non-Christian perspective, we live in a universe where man, as Francis Schaeffer said, is nothing more than an abnormal reward upon the smooth face of the silent meaningless universe, is just what he said. The non-Christian would perceive the universe in a meaningless type of way. How can you talk about good and evil? Where do you get your moral absolutes? I hear a lot of talk about moral absolutes, but I don't know what your basis is. As Christians, we believe that there is a moral absolute. So we can look at the girl in the outhouse and say, that is evil. As a non-Christian, you cannot look at the girl in the outhouse and say, that's evil. On no basis can you do that.
Seems to me you've been listening to some tapes.
Please defend me.
Well, there's another
Christian.
I mean, really, on what basis are you talking about?
Let me try to explicate here, lay out with a little more detail what was going on in this exchange between Nelson and myself.
Yeah, but what about the point where we came up there, why would a good God allow us to see that thing?
Yeah, well,
that's what we did.
We're gonna come to that eventually. What I want to do now, the second step in my pedagogical technique here, is to take the two basic schools of apologetics and show you how they would deal with the problem of evil. An evidentialist would say, this is really a problem. However, God has given us evidence that he exists and the Bible is true. And if you'll listen to the evidence, hopefully you'll believe that that evidence is strong enough to overwhelm or counterbalance the evidence against the Christian faith that comes from the problem of evil. So now look, let's go through this argument for the resurrection of Jesus Christ. We go through that, and we say very probably Jesus rose from the dead. And that means very probably he's God, and very probably everything he says is true, and very probably the Bible is the word of God. And so we do have some evidence over here that the Bible is true. Now, what you have presented as an unbeliever is some difficulty with that, because we have evil, and frankly, we don't know why God allowed evil. He hasn't given us an answer. He's only asked us to trust him. And so if you think the evidence I've given you for the resurrection is strong enough, then hopefully you can entrust yourself to him and say, I don't have to have an answer to the problem of evil, because there's this positive evidence, and I'm willing, on the basis of faith, to let God have his way. Now, that's not my making up what the evidentialist says. That's my very quick and oversimple summary of what I've read over and over and over again as evidentialists try to deal with the problem of evil. Essentially, they say, yes, that's tough, but we have some positive evidence, too. And when you put them all together, hopefully you'll think that there's a favorable balance for Christianity over against this. What's the problem with that? One, I don't think that is totally glorifying to God to say, well, there's some evidence for you and there's some evidence against you. And then, as far as I'm concerned, we'll tip the hat in favor of God. Now, I realize that's not looking bad at the evidentialist, and I'm role-playing here in a way that's unfair to them. But nevertheless, it comes down to that. Moreover, philosophically, that does not even counterbalance the problem of evil. Because the philosopher who's using the problem of evil doesn't say, evil seems to be some evidence against God, but there are these miracles that are some evidence for God, and I think there's more evil than there are miracles. Well, obviously there's more evil than there are miracles, just not to think about it. But that's not the point. The unbeliever says, all of the claims in the world about miracles will not stack up to even 1 ounce of positive evidence if the system of thought is contradictory. Okay? let's say that I come to you and I say, you know what my philosophy of life is? My philosophy of life is men exist, then he is not the case of men exist. That is not philosophy of life. And somebody says, no, wait a minute, wait a minute. There's something wrong with that. It's contradictory. You're holding premises that cannot both be true because they conflict with each other. And I defend myself and I say, no, wait a minute, wait a minute. Look around you. Don't you see men? Isn't there positive evidence that men exist? And on the other hand, if you look in other places where there are no men, is it not true as well that men do not exist? There seems to be some evidence there in favor of my contradictory thesis. Now, would anybody accept that philosophy of life on that kind of defense? They'd say, no, wait a minute. Don't you see? I mean, don't you understand that this contradiction cannot be overcome by evidence? There can't be evidence for a contradictory thesis. We're not talking about there being a little bit of evidence or not enough evidence or just barely enough evidence or overwhelming evidence. There can't be any evidence for a contradiction. In the same way, when the unbelieving philosopher says, you believe a contradiction. You believe God's all-loving, he's all-powerful, and yet evil's here. He should be loving enough to want to eliminate it and powerful enough to do so, and yet it's here. That's a contradiction. And you can't go and say, but we have evidence that there really is just this kind of God. Because the issue here is one of contradiction. Not a matter of, well, there's all these negative vibes over here and all these positive vibes over here, and you decide which one has the most gripping power on. Because the positive evidence doesn't mean a thing in light of the contradiction in the Christian system.
What about the evidence in the Book of Revelations, which seems to indicate someday God will use his power?
Well, maybe he will someday overcome it. The question is, why did he ever allow it? He should be good enough not to want it, and he should be powerful enough to have what he wants. So why was there ever evil there?
You're saying that because there is a little bit of negative evidence that it shoots in the
No, I'm saying that the claim of the unbelieving philosopher is that the problem of evil is not a little bit of negative evidence. The problem of evil shows that there's an inherent contradiction in the Christian faith, and therefore there can't be any evidence in favor of it. And when you say, well, the resurrection's evidence, you say it's not evidence for this theory, because you can't have evidence for a contradictory theory. The resurrection may prove that three things happen in history. You must send it to Ripley's Believe It or Not. You know, maybe it'll end up on That's Incredible. But nevertheless, it cannot be evidence for the truth of Christianity, because Christianity has an inherent contradiction. I'm trying to make you see that the problem of evil is not a matter of balancing the positive evidence and the negative evidence. The problem of evil says this is not negative evidence, this is a refutation. It's not just, well, you know, doesn't this make you wonder a little bit? No, it's saying you can't believe that at all. Not at all. Not just a little or just enough or a little bit more than that. You can't believe a contradiction at all. Any more than you can believe, I believe that many exist, but I believe that it's not the case many exist.
What you're saying, just to clarify something, what you're saying is the problem of evil is contradictory if we don't properly deal with the problem of evil.
I'm saying that that is the claim of the unbeliever,
yeah.
That the problem of evil shows Christianity to be contradictory. Okay?
This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bonson Institute. Duplication, sharing, and distribution is encouraged. For more information about the life and ministry of Dr. Greg L. Bonson, visit our website, bonsoninstitute.com, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.